Hi everyone. Today I am talking to Professor Emilia Jamrosiak, who is a professor of medieval history here at the University of Leeds. And Emilia, what I hoped we could do today was talk a little bit about your own research background, how you became interested in the topics that you're currently working on. And then we might talk a little bit about two of the projects you're currently engaged with. But I wondered if I could start by asking you how you became a medievalist.
Oh, that's a very nice question. I think I became medievalist because I like to be able to be in control of my material and not to be swamped and lost in the seeming avalanche of information. And I actually like the kind of detective work that medieval historians have to do to put together extremely scarce and fragmentary evidence into coherent and convincing story, which of course will be then debated by other people. And this convincing story will be forever changing. So I think that's that kind of creative aspect. I don't mean in terms of fiction, but definitely creative aspect of medieval history very much appeals to me. And of course, opportunity to work not just with text, but also with objects, images, and material culture more broadly.
That's fascinating. And I wondered what it was particularly about medieval religion that drew you in as a topic of study.
I think because it is simply a very, very different world to modern Western society, in a sense that I like to, as a historian, to be in a very different world. What is this actually alien? I like that aspect, to be foreigner in a world I'm studying, which doesn't mean that it doesn't resonate with us. It does in many ways, but it is fundamentally different world. And I like trying to explain how it works, and also because I think it helps us to understand things like variety of views or even very different paradigms to understand the world now, which we are experiencing.
I find that so interesting in my own teaching, you know, particularly when teaching early modern religion, so 16th and 17th century religion. It's really exciting to explore with students a variety of perspectives that they might not have understood before, and to kind of really try and get ourselves into those mental worlds of the past. And I wanted to ask about some of the projects that you've been engaged on recently, because Emilia, you're someone who's incredibly creative and productive and seems to always be kind of doing these incredibly exciting projects. So I'm going to just pick two for now, if that's all right. And the first was your AHRC, Arts and Humanities Research Council funded project, which I think is called The Sacred Landscapes of Medieval Monasticism. And obviously this is a huge project. I wondered if you might tell us a little bit, even about one aspect of this that you've been working on.
Yes, absolutely. It's a lot of people involved in it, and PI is based in Wales. And with another colleague from University of Lampeter, Professor Janet Burton, and our research assistant, Dr. Cathy Dutton, we are working on a very interesting material from Lincolnshire on Kirkstead Abbey, and its cartulary. It's a very specific type of source created in the context of monastic houses. But what we find really intellectually profitable coming out of this research is new aspects of understanding how memory and information retention worked in medieval monastic communities, and how information about places in this cartulary and what came, for example, in the ownership of the abbey, can be then brought into dialogue with new archaeological work.
Yeah, that's fascinating to think about the interplay then between what we might think of as traditional historical sources and then working with archaeologists. Can you tell us a little more about that?
Yes, absolutely. What's been so far, probably the most important finding of our aspects of the project, is how actually Cistercians were making decisions where to settle, where to establish new houses. There's a long historiography behind it, and there was since, well, until really 1990, there was the idea when it's been observed in historiography quite clearly that many Cistercian houses first settled in one place and then they moved on somewhere. And that used to be interpreted, oh, they simply made mistakes. And from what emerges from Kirkstead, it clearly is, no, it was actually planned strategy. You stay somewhere else until you build your new home. And that allowed to revise the various archaeological hypotheses, but that led to even further, in terms of what's been visible archaeologically, not, I'm not talking about new excavation, especially now this is not possible to do, but reinterpretation of significance of specific locations which were outside the walls of monastery, yet played a very important role in interaction with the local communities and the kind of place that this monastic community had in landscape. Lincolnshire is a particularly interesting area in England in terms of long-term cultural significance and religious and cult significance of various locations, going back to Bronze Age or even earlier, and very, very intriguing continuities. So this project also addresses work that's been done over at least two decades by archaeology and bringing it in different contexts. And what is important about this cooperation, that we are basically working from the same agenda, because that's fundamentally what success of interdisciplinary work is, that we are not having different, in a sense, questionnaire, what we want to, you know, series of questions, what we want to, as historians, as archaeologists, answer, but actually we have the same question and we try to arrive at a common solution that combines these two perspectives.
It's really fascinating to see those different disciplines working together. And so interesting to hear what you say about, you know, people sometimes think about medieval monasteries as being, you know, these islands of faith that are kind of cut off from the world. But it sounds like your findings are showing all of these links with the wider landscape and with the local community. Is that right?
Oh, absolutely. And that's something that it's monasticism is, not just in medieval context and not just in Christianity. In all cultures that exist, monks are in the worldview of the societies that see them as important element. They are literally people in between the worlds. They occupy a very specific place, which creates a sort of sense of ritual purity and so on. But they are essential as intercessors for the wider world. And that role of intercession creates huge range of very important bonds, which are, and these bonds in terms of monastic, that is cloistered, not mendicant communities, create bonds that last beyond death. And they are very also important in long-term continuity, lasting for centuries. And of course, that creates huge amounts of very intriguing cultural material, different kinds of sources, because of course, these communities themselves reflect over their own past, both if you think about Europe, already in little later Middle Ages, but it's also this problem of how do you engage as a monastic community with your own past. It's something that carries on, of course, beyond Middle Ages.
It's a sense of their own history. It's so interesting to think about. I was just thinking, you know, as a historian in Leeds, one of the things that's almost impossible, you can't not do if you live in this city, is have your eye drawn to the beautiful remains of Kirkstall Abbey, just down the road from us at the university. And it's a place I love to visit. It's a place I love to walk around. But that got me thinking a little bit about another project that you've been working on very intensively over the last year or even longer. And that's this project on afterlives of medieval monasticism. And this sounds like a project that's very different in its focus to the one you've just described. I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about it.
Yes, absolutely. This project is funded by Marie Curie and Horizon 2020 funding at Erfurt Universität in Germany in Thuringia. And that is really very different, because it's not about Middle Ages as such. It's about creation of a historiography or a perspective on monasticism in 19th and 20th century. It's not a systematic study of it, but I focus on three themes that I consider particularly fundamental. And I think implication of my work go beyond monastic history. I think that they will be interesting for other historians working on religious and cultural pre-modern history. And basically, I'm focusing on three themes. One is constructions of origins, how historiography constructs origins of monastic institutions, but also in terms of editions of sources. We know that how sources are edited has fundamental impact of what's in them and what kind of question we ask and we cannot ask. Then there is a very big theme, what happened in the 19th century, and we still live in a sense with legacy of that, where history of monasticism met with a paradigm of national history. So what happens where institutions and culture, essentially, that was not bound by national boundaries, was to some extent, of course, engaged with national languages, but it's not something that was, it was basically trans-European network. What happens when it meets with completely new way of presenting history, in which an understanding, in which everything needs to be explained by nation state and needs to, in a sense, conform to its importance and construction of that. As I say, we still live with legacy of that. And in some extreme cases in parts of Central Europe, it means that, for example, the same regions or in that case, monastic houses located there have completely competing histories in which they are exponent of one or the other national and political aims. And then the third element is the impact of theory of modernization on monastic historiography. I mean, that's a huge area because there is a lot of things that I, in a sense, bring under the umbrella of theory of modernization. First of all, Weberian inspired ideas of rationality, but it is also theories of secularization and even, in a sense, competing models that came out of social sciences, such as core periphery or center and periphery, been also used in archaeology, for example, but been very much used to explain development or kind of expansion of Europe, especially eastwards, but also towards the south in high Middle Ages. And again, of course, monasteries being brought into this narrative. So there's still a lot to be done with this project, but I think I have already interesting findings, which I hope I will be able to publish in shorter version in forms of articles, but ultimately I hope it will be a book.
Oh, I'll be really looking forward to reading both the articles and the book. It's great what you say about the kind of national stories that get told about medieval monasticism. And it makes me think of a book that used to be very popular both in Ireland and in America about early medieval monasticism, yeah. Which was called How the Irish Saved Civilization. So there were certain claims being made that were kind of maybe based on this nation state idea. And I wanted to just zoom in on one aspect of what you said. And I was really interested because, you know, many students, when they come to university, will be working with editions of sources. So whether that's, you know, translated medieval sources or collections of source materials. And I was really interested by what you said about how you need to approach those materials, certainly with a critical eye. And I wondered if you could tell us a tiny bit more about the kind of work you've been doing with source editions.
Mm-hmm. So, for example, I am interested in time regimes. That means how the constructions of time, in a way, shape how sources that have been constructed, created, these texts were created in completely different understanding of time, how these two things collide. It has a lot of implications. That's been, for example, in the last couple of years, quite a lot of voices in the kind of international community of scholars of monasticism. We have to stop looking at it in a linear terms. So that it's a neat story of progress and from one form of monasticism to another. And in course of my project, I've been also thinking, okay, how we can how we can deconstruct it effectively, what can be alternative to it, and that's directly connected with the source editions. An example that I've been the most familiar with and I found very powerful is edition of something called the Statutes of the General Chapter of the Cistercians. Cistercians, which is order I work the most with, they emerge in late 11th, early 12th century. It kind of shaped themselves in the first half of 12th century as an organized order. And they had this new form of organization that other institutions took over from them, is that they have this kind of meetings, yearly meetings, and which representative, basically abbots from whole Europe meet. And there are records of that. They are not, of course, how modern records look like. It's only decisions. But the discussions were secret. They are not meant to be noted. And the levels of detail is very hugely. And the first edition of that was created in 1930s. And it creates a lovely, clear narrative progress of how this institution developed and how the Cistercian body made decision how they should be organized. And it made a very strong idea who they are. And then in early 2000, there was a new edition made of the first volume, which has shown that it's complete construction. None of these meetings actually happened in the first up to mid 12th century in that form. It's in a sense illusion of order and kind of neat progress. This is one example. And second, of course, is all kinds of sources linked to liturgical practices or necrologies, which in a sense collapse time. So where information often from not just decades, sometimes even centuries are brought together, and it's not important in which year it happened because it's plotted on circular time. Importance of new forms of editions of such, especially in digital means open now very different ways where we can have much greater sensitivity to these other time regimes and circular time, which is so important in monastic context.
What you mentioned there about kind of the digitization of sources and kind of more access to them kind of brings me naturally to my last question, which is thinking about research and teaching. And you teach at all levels of undergrad and MA here at Leeds. And I wondered if there are ways in which your research informs your teaching.
A lot. And also my teaching informs my research. It's a circular process. One thing I suppose I could have added to my first answer why I became medieval historians, what it always intrigued me about medieval monasticism, is the notion of reciprocity. And I think that's a fundamental for any kind of human community. Without reciprocity, we are doomed. In that sense, it also, my teaching, I try to do my teaching in the sense of reciprocity. So my research informs my teaching. My teaching informs my research. So, for example, I teach very broadly religious cultural history on the undergraduate level. So I not just Christian. I also teach medieval Jewish history because I think it's very important that within the Leeds curriculum, we offered also perspective at non-Christian pre-modern history and its significance. Also, by teaching medieval Jewish history, I am able to explain to students how issue of minority-majority dynamics works. Issue also, of course, of persecution, stigmatization works. And these are all, of course, important themes. I also teach on the undergraduate level courses that specifically focus on some of the most intriguing aspects of medieval religious cultures, for example, cult of saints. I teach it not from a perspective, for example, of simply text as hagiography, but rather what society did with saints in the Middle Ages. They were incredibly important figures to be interacted with, to be afraid of, but also, of course, hope that they will channel all sorts of things. And there is huge amounts of really interesting textual and material evidence that I use in my teaching. And that module, for example, directly contributed to the book that will be published next year with Amsterdam University Press on the cult of saints in monastic communities in the later Middle Ages, on the example of Cistercians, mostly in southern Germany, but not only. And I also teach popular belief. So the kind of blurred area between official and unofficial in the Middle Ages. And also elements, for example, of a bigger collaborative module on medieval magic and generally ideas about supernatural in the Middle Ages, which are also very, very significant to understand a medieval worldview, so to say, and constructions of the world for the medieval society. And at the MA level, I teach more directly to do with my research on religious experience, individual and communal. So religious communities play quite a big role in that.
That's fascinating. I think you're right to mention the fact that it's not just that our research informs our teaching, which of course it does, but also that we often draw from our own teaching. It's certainly true for me to inform the research that we do. Emilia, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me today. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you so much. It's been a great pleasure for me. Thank you.
Thank you.